From WXXI News, this is Healthy Friday and Second Opinion Live. I'm your host, Elisa Orlando. Thank you so much for being with us. Our topic for this hour is one that is important, vital to many people, and to 1 in 13 children. It's food allergies. We're very pleased to be producing this hour in association with the National Public TV show, Second Opinion, and the University of Rochester Medical Center in Rochester, New York. And today's broadcast is part of the Second Opinion Live webcast series, which means you can watch it later online if you're not already watching it online. You can watch right now at secondopinion-tv.org, and you can participate in today's conversation a number of ways. You can call us at 1-844-295-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 844-295-8255, no matter where you are in the country. And you can tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP. That's the hashtag 2NDOP. And we already have some questions from Twitter. We're going to get to them in just a moment. First, I want to introduce our guest today. Our guest who's in our studio is Dr. Shahzad Mustafa, Doctor of Allergy and Clinical Immunology at the Rochester General Medical Group and Clinical Assistant Professor of Medicine at University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Mustafa will be helping to answer your questions throughout the hour, so we welcome your calls and your tweets. I'll be giving out the number throughout the hour, too. A special thanks to the sponsor of Second Opinion, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. It's through their support and generosity that we can provide you with timely, accurate, and valuable health information through programs like this and through Second Opinion. And thank you to our public radio and television supporters who help make shows like this possible. Thanks for your support. Okay, let's get started. Dr. Mustafa, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Food allergies are on the rise in this country, and nobody is really certain why that is. The CDC says one of every 13 children has a food allergy now. There are growing numbers of adults. What do you think is going on?
Yep, so there's 2 points there. Food allergies are truly on the rise. All allergic diseases on the rise, whether that be atopic dermatitis or eczema, food allergies, environmental allergies, or asthma. And we don't. There's a lot of theories of why there may be, but we don't have any exact answers yet. Part two of that, though, is that food allergies are also often overdiagnosed. So self-reported food allergies, there's a big rate of individuals out there who have been potentially mistakenly diagnosed with food allergies. So you want to have the true numbers. But in fact, with the true numbers, food allergies are still increasing.
All right. So you say that they're overdiagnosed, and that is something that we almost never hear in the media about overdiagnosis. We tend to hear more about the sort of life and death situations. What do you mean when you say they're overdiagnosed?
So food allergies, a diagnosis, just like most things in medicine, the most important thing is talking to the patient or the individual. There's no magic test. There's no yes-no test. Are you or are you not allergic to a food? And sometimes tests are ordered. The two most common tests for food allergies are blood work to look at antibody levels and then skin testing. And there's a high rate, if you're just going to go based on those tests alone, you're going to overdiagnose food allergies because those tests aren't diagnostic. It's not a yes or no test. And that's a very important point.
So there can be a food sensitivity that's not exactly an allergy or some kind of resistance or something?
Yep. So when you do those tests, all that tells you is that your body has seen the food, it's been exposed to the food, and it's made an antibody to the food. The presence of the antibody does not make someone allergic. So there's a lot of folks out there who have antibodies that you could find with skin testing or blood work that aren't truly allergic to the food. So the history is critical. And when physicians order these tests in the absence of a history that suggests a food allergy, sometimes we get into trouble, I think.
All right, so let's go to the idea of food allergies. That you said in the beginning of the program that the diagnosis of food allergies is on the rise. There are more food allergies. Some of the most common culprits, nuts, milk, wheat, egg, shellfish, soy, they're some of the foods that most commonly set off reactions. Is there something that all of these products have in common?
Yeah, so you're right. There's 8 foods that account for the vast majority of food allergies. And the key with food allergies, it's the protein structure of the food you're talking about. The protein has to be able to be recognized by your immune system by certain antibodies, IgE antibodies, that then trigger the reaction. So all foods don't have the protein that's able to kind of trigger off or set off that reaction.
All right, so they do say they do have something in common. Now, when we talk about allergies, we often associate it with children, and children can be very much at risk. It can be a life or death situation. As you know, we're taking questions on Twitter today. People are tweeting to the hashtag 2NDOP, and our first question comes in from Cindy. She wants to know if you can outgrow food allergies. We're going to talk about kids in a moment, but a lot of times we're diagnosed when we're kids. Can you outgrow food allergies?
You absolutely can outgrow food allergies. In fact, I would say the vast majority of food allergies are outgrown. Children, for example, are commonly allergic to milk or eggs, wheat or soy, and over 90% of those individuals would outgrow those food allergies, typically between 5 to 10 years of age. Sometimes it lasts into adolescence, but you do outgrow them. The food allergies that we tend not to outgrow are peanuts, tree nuts, shellfish, maybe even sesame. But even those, there are a certain percentage of individuals who do outgrow those. 20% of people outgrow peanut allergy, 15% outgrow tree nut allergy. Generally, the earlier you develop the allergy, the better likely you have of outgrowing it during
so
your
lifetime. So the sooner you get it, the chances are better that you might
outgrow it. Generally, if you develop an peanut allergy as a child versus as a 30-year-old adult, you have a better chance of outgrowing it as a child.
All right, we're talking about food allergies today on Second Opinion Live and on Healthy Friday. You can call in and ask a question. We have a toll-free number now for those of you who listen in Rochester, New York. Our number is now toll-free, but you'll still get through to the studio. It's 844-295-8255, 295-TALK, and that's a toll-free number. Let's start with a few more basics about allergies, Dr. Mustafa. When an allergic reaction takes place, the immune system makes a substance that we normally think of as pretty innocuous, pretty innocent, but it goes over the edge. Is that safe to say? And will you tell us what happens in the body when it encounters
sure.
the substance?
So the first thing is you can't be allergic to something you've never truly been exposed to before. So you're exposed to a food or anything either once or several times. Those exposures create antibodies in your body. And those antibodies generally kind of just hang out until the episode where you're exposed yet again, so either a second exposure or subsequent exposures. And then those antibodies kind of link onto these cells called mast cells, and you release a whole slew of chemicals. We're familiar with histamine. A lot of people are familiar with histamine, antihistamines. That's one of the chemicals. There's a whole slew of other inflammatory chemicals that happens, and that leads to an allergic reaction. I think another important point is 90% of reactions to food happen within 20 minutes of the exposure. It's a very acute onset, and they're pretty stereotypical. Rash, itchy rash, trouble breathing, nausea, vomiting, and 99% of reactions happen within 2 hours. So food allergies, the reactions, the episodes generally are not vague. I think the one caveat there is in little people, really little kids, 4 months old, 6 months old, they're less stereotypical.
So they may get a little reaction?
They tend to do some things sometimes that are more chronic. They have difficulty gaining weight. They have changes in bowel habits. They're a little more fussy. But as people get older, allergic reactions to foods become more and more typical. I eat a food. I have hives. I have trouble breathing. If I don't eat the food, I generally don't have those symptoms.
All right. Are all – this is a may sound like a strange question, but let me ask it and then we'll go from there. Are all food allergies created equal?
Yeah. So all food allergies are not created equal.
Okay.
I think every food has unique properties that you need to be aware of when you're taking care of these folks. I mean, for example, you need to know that if you're allergic to eggs, the vast majority of people who are allergic to eggs will tolerate an egg in a baked good, like a birthday cake, for example, or even for milk, 70% is the case. But if you're allergic to peanut, there's no form of peanut that you're going to tolerate. So you can't put your, you know, peanut butter cookie in the oven, cook it for 30 minutes and eat that if you're peanut allergic. So that's a difference between the foods. The rates of outgrowing it, the risk of lethal reactions, all varies depending on the food you're talking about.
Is it the same for amounts? So if you have a peanut allergy, you can't eat even the least bit of peanut or have it touch you? Or, I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, truly, if you're allergic to a food, you have to avoid it 100%. Even a small amount is capable of triggering a significant systemic, anaphylactic, or life-threatening reaction. For example, for peanut, if you take one peanut kernel and divide it into about 325 parts, one of those parts has been shown to cause a systemic reaction leading to anaphylaxis. And that's true for all food allergies. So one of the difficulties with food allergies and the impairment on quality of life is you do truly need to read labels for foods depending on what they are and really do need to truly avoid them.
All right. And you can imagine when talking about families, adults are one thing, but there are many, many stories, even though we talk about technical terms like anaphylaxis and severe responses. There are many stories of families where their lives have been ruined or significantly changed because their kids can't eat certain things and they can't touch certain things. And we've seen stories. I read a story in the New York Times recently about a young girl who was afraid to go out of the house without her mother. She wouldn't eat. You know, these kinds of things happen to families over time as they deal with allergies. Is that what you see coming
into
your
practice?
We see
a lot of this. And there's two parts of any condition, including food allergies. There's the impact it has on quality of life, and then there's the impact it has on kind of morbidity and mortality and the risk of death. And it is true, food allergies, you certainly can have bad outcomes, and people do die every year from food allergies. But if you look at the literature, if you look at the science, that number is generally pretty small. The amount of deaths in the United States of America from anaphylaxis of any type is a relatively small number, on the order of 200 to 300 folks a year. If you take that to foods, it goes down even lower than that.
Is that because, say, a parent can get an EpiPen and inject their child, or is it because there's just really good management of the allergy? What's the reason?
I think there's multiple points. I mean, I think awareness helps diagnosis and treatment. Treatment is leads to avoidance, and treatment with epinephrine, which we can certainly talk about during this hour. And, you know, I think there is some redundancy in the human body where we kind of have some self-protection from this. So there's that aspect of it. But then the quality of life aspect is gigantic. And everyone with any chronic condition, and I don't think food allergy is an illness, by the way, it's a condition, has an impact on their quality of life. It should. And I come from one hat where I'm a physician who takes care of this, but I come from another hat where I'm a father also with a 15-month-old with peanut and nut allergy.
Okay. So just diagnosed, right?
Recently diagnosed within the last month or two. So I can wear both hats, and it's certainly, as much as I know and feel comfortable knowing, it does still impact my quality of life, and it should, because you have to be careful. But the quality of life impairment, one of my big things when I see folks and chat with folks, is what you do has to be based in science and information and not misinformation. And just like food allergies have been on the rise recently, they weren't around very much 20 or 30 years ago. So in the world of medicine, that's pretty new. And with new things, there's often a lot of misinformation. We don't know a lot. So when we don't know a lot, there's a lot of room for misinformation. And unfortunately, I think there's a decent amount of out there in the media and the public, and that fosters even more kind of an alarmist attitude.
Give me an example of what you mean by misinformation. What is something that that you've heard that you just, or that someone that you know is doing that you just don't think they should be doing?
Yeah, I mean, certainly these are comfort levels. I think diagnosis is important, and I think a lot of folks are misinformed on how food allergies are diagnosed and what symptoms they may cause. You know, I see a lot of folks who come in with chronic, you know, abdominal discomfort and fatigue, and they're worried about multiple food allergies, and that's generally not the case. A real, real hot button topic that, you know, I steer clear of sometimes, but if we can certainly talk about the science,
but not today,
is the risk of reactions with airborne exposure to peanuts or any food for that matter. And we can certainly delve into that because there's a lot of great science out there, but the science, unfortunately, I think has been trumped by kind of public opinion, which I don't think is totally always rooted in the science.
Okay, we have lots of questions coming in on Twitter. People are tweeting to the hashtag 2NDOP. You can also call us no matter where you are watching or listening today. Our telephone number is 844-295-8255. That's 844-295-TALK if you'd like to ask a question. Our guest in studio is Dr. Shahzad Mustafa from Rochester General Health System, and he's talking to us about food allergies. Let me back up a little bit. You just talked about the fact that you have a 15-month-old son that was recently diagnosed and that you know that it's going to be a challenge. And when you say that one sentence, with all respect, do you think you have a sense of what really lies ahead in terms of what yours and his and your family's life might be like? I have read a lot about families that just that they have to watch every move they make, and that significantly changes families.
Absolutely. So, you know, parenthood doesn't have a cookbook, right? So every stage changes. He's 15 months and crazy and hanging off the pantry right now. Then he's going to go to school in a couple years, and peanut allergy, you know, 20% outgrow. And the best predictor of who outgrows peanut allergy is actually blood work showing your levels of IgE, and his are pretty high, so he may be taking this allergy to college unless treatment changes, which personally I think it will, but that's another topic. But so every stage does come in with its own challenges, but you know, within a week or two of him being diagnosed, he was on a plane with my wife, his brother and his sister. We were going on a trip to Arizona. We stayed in a hotel. We ate out for every meal for a week. So although we are reading labels, we've changed a little bit of what we're doing for diet in the house, obviously not exposing him. We still absolutely have peanut products in the home. We still have nut products in the home. We're still doing everything that we would have done 3 months ago when we didn't know he was allergic.
Okay, so the other kids are going to eat what they can eat, and he's going to eat what he can.
Absolutely. So I think food allergies, it's important to know that getting back to some of this airborne exposure stuff, the risk of airborne exposure causing a systemic reaction to foods is really scientifically never been borne out in the literature. And that is the only food that has been scientifically proven to cause airborne reactions is seafood. And again, it goes back to every food's not created equal, and it goes back to the protein. Seafood protein, fish, shellfish, aerosolizes into the air very nicely. Other foods, you know, cow's milk, eggs, wheat, peanut, the protein doesn't aerosolize very well. So the risk of airborne reaction or airborne exposure causing a systemic reaction is exceedingly low. You never say never, but it's close to never. Taking it to home, when my 15-month-old is around, we still have nuts around. We still eat nuts. Now, I'm not saying his 3-year-old brother should be eating a PB&J because he's a mess.
You don't want him to touch.
Right. It's touching and getting around on toys. But in the absence of that, as an adult, you know, I just had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich around him for lunch a couple of days ago, and he was running around and playing, and that's absolutely safe. I'm not being cavalier. I mean, it's my son. I care about him as much as anything, right? But it's not being cavalier. I think it's being informed. And these aren't opinions. There's lovely studies out there that can prove this stuff that that we take back to our individuals and our patients.
All right, we're going to talk about the research in a moment, too. We're in the studio right now with Dr. Shahzad Mustafa, and he's answering our questions about food allergies. We have some telephone calls, and we have some questions on Twitter. Let's take a telephone call right now. Jenna's on the line from Pittsford. Thanks for holding on. Jenna, you have a question?
I have a question and a comment. My son has been sick since he was a baby, a very small baby with food allergies. It took a long time to diagnose him, and we've managed it well in our family. We've recently seen Dr. Mustafa's partner, who diagnosed him with peanut allergy in addition to everything we already know. He's allergic to milk, soy, strawberries, green beans, bee stings, etc. But one of the other issues that I think is really important is the social aspect of food allergies. And one of my questions for the doctor is, do you have an opinion on how schools should be handling this? Because he, although he legally should be able to eat lunch in a school, schools are not equipped, capable, or interested in taking steps to help our children eat safely in schools. I'll hang up and listen to you take the question.
Thanks for the question, Jenna. That's a lot of information and a lot to handle. She's asking about the social aspect, but also I can imagine that in school it can be difficult for families.
That's a great question, and it's a big point. And I think there's no one-size-fits-all. I have done some work consulting with schools, including as part of a committee that we actually had recommendations on how schools in Massachusetts should handle school allergy. And I honestly think it is different depending on what level of school you're in. If you're in a daycare with 1-year-olds and 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds, you handle that very differently than grade school or high school. Or I was just contacted by a local university this week about their policy about dormitories. So every level is different. I do think unfortunately, the bad thing is food allergies are on the rise. The good thing is I think that helps raise awareness. I do think people generally have a genuine interest in doing the right thing, but a lot of it stems from education, and I think the education needs to get better. I don't think people still to this day know what is the appropriate treatment for an accidental ingestion for any food, whether it be peanut or milk or wheat. That's very important, and myself, my partners, Dr. Teresa Bingaman, who's one of my partners, did a pretty large conference in town with I think most every school nurse in the area on what is the appropriate management for this stuff. So education is key.
Is it one size fits all in terms of treatment? if there's a reaction, or is it very individualized? Do nurses have to learn each student? Do schools need to know each student?
There I will, you know, never one size fits all, but it's pretty close to one size fits all for food allergy. For food allergy today, as of today, you avoid the culprit food. For any systemic reaction, and that I mean anything that's beyond local itching of the mouth or maybe a local rash on the face, anything beyond that requires treatment with epinephrine if you're going to do it right.
And that's the pen, right? The EpiPen, they call it?
There's two devices on the market now. Historically, there's been EpiPen, which looks like, you know, like a thick pen. It's just intramuscular. You put it in your thigh and inject it. There's a new device as of March of 2013, I think, called AviQ, same medicine, same dose, comes out of a machine. That is the only, epinephrine is the only treatment for anaphylaxis or a systemic reaction. So we see, not only by families or parents, but physicians, EMS, we see antihistamines like Benadryl hugely overused for treatment of systemic reactions, and that is wrong. So that's a huge part of education that we need to get out.
All right, let's take a question from Twitter now. Jason asked a question on Twitter, tweeting to the hashtag 2NDOP. Jason's question is there a way to better reduce allergies over time? And Jason has added some ideas here, local honey, unpasteurized milk, et cetera, things like that, I guess more organic products without things in them that may or may not be culprits?
Yeah. So these are great questions that are coming with a lot of information. So there's obviously a lot of research. Anything that's increasing in prevalence, like food allergy, we'd like to not only take care of folks who have it, but decrease the prevalence, right? So from food allergy, I think more and more research is showing, and this really started changing about 2009, 2010 with lots of studies, a lot of them came out of England, is that the earlier introduction of foods decreases the risk of food allergies. Does not make them zero, but decreases the risk. So I know 10 years ago we would tell you to avoid peanuts for your child until they were 2 or 3 or some arbitrary number that we had picked. That's wrong. There's no way around that. The earlier you introduce any of these foods probably helps decrease the risk of allergy. It doesn't make it zero. Jason's question also mentioned unpasteurized milk.
Right.
That's interesting because allergic disease in many ways is a problem of the first world, not a third world. There's very little allergic disease in third world countries. There's very little food allergy in third world countries. So what are we doing different than they doing different? And believe it or not, if you take it home to just America, if you're raised on a farm, you have a lot less likelihood of having allergic disease, whether it be asthma or environmental allergies or food allergy, than if you were raised 100 miles away in an urban setting. So again, what are the differences? Well, there's a lot of research going on looking at these differences. We don't have any specific answers. Probiotics, honey supplementation, dietary supplementation, herbal medication, all hot topics, a lot of ongoing research. As of today, I can't give you any definitive answers.
So what you know right now is that the earlier the exposure, the less of a chance there is that somebody will have an allergy, but it's not really prevention necessarily. You can't call it prevention at this point,
It's risk modification, I would say. I cannot tell you there's anything we can do to prevent you from having a food allergy, but I think there's things we can do to help decrease your risk of food allergies.
Is there a genetic component at all?
Absolutely. I think most things in medicine have a two-hit hypothesis. You're born with a genetic predisposition, and then something happens at life in some point along the way. Genetic predisposition tips over to the condition that you have. Yeah.
All right, we're taking telephone calls today from anywhere, whether you're watching in our video webcast of Second Opinion Live or listening to us on the radio. Our toll-free number is 844-295-8255. The toll-free number is 844-295-TALK, or you can tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP. Our guest in studio today is Dr. Shahzad Mustafa. He's with Rochester General Health System, and he's answering your questions about food allergies. I'm Elisa Orlando. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of Second Opinion Live on Healthy Friday right after this.
I'm Evan Dawson. Coming up Monday on The Next Connections, we delve into net neutrality. What is net neutrality? How does it impact you? What are the recent developments and what is driving them? We'll have your questions answered by experts in the field and stakeholders in the debate about our internet. It's all coming up on Monday on Connections with Evan Dawson.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you.
Welcome back to Second Opinion Live and to Healthy Friday on WXXI and on WXXI.org. This is part of a webcast, a Healthy Friday webcast called Second Opinion Live, produced in association with the National Public Television show Second Opinion. Our guest in studio today is Dr. Shahzad Mustafa, Director of Allergy and Clinical Immunology at Rochester General Medical Group and Clinical Assistant Professor of Medicine at University of Rochester Medical Center. Our topic is, of course, food allergies. I'd like to take a moment to thank the sponsor of Second Opinion, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. Their support helps to make Second Opinion Live possible. And of course, you can watch us and may be watching us on the web right now at secondopinion-tv.org. You can join our conversation, especially if you have questions about food allergies, by calling us. The number is 844-295-8255. 295-TALK. Or you can join us on Twitter using the hashtag 2NDOP. And we've been talking about the social aspects of food allergies. We have been talking about the things that go on in the body with food allergies. The idea, Dr. Mustafa is saying, that there may be some overdiagnosis of food allergies. And when families have to react to this, they have to deal with lots of things. The food in the house, the food at school, what's going on at school, what's happening in the physician's office. We have a question from Twitter, which we'll use to start off this half hour, that says, this question says, schools seem to make everyone not bring in peanut butter sandwiches, et cetera, because they're worried about food allergies. Is that the answer? Just kind of restrict the whole and hope to cut down on the risk to certain kids?
Yeah, believe it or so, peanut-free zones is always a point of discussion. And believe it or not, schools, there's been studies that have shown that peanut-free zones or peanut-free classrooms or peanut-free schools has actually never really been shown to decrease your risk of reaction. So that's, I think, an important point. The individual who's peanut allergic or any food allergic needs to still remain vigilant about asking about where what ingredients are in the foods, what other people are bringing in. And quite honestly, one of the very important things with students in school is food sharing becomes very difficult to impossible. And I generally do counsel my folks who, in grade school, middle school, elementary school, you know, food sharing is something that you have to be very, very careful with unless you are very comfortable knowing who is responsible for making that food. So generally, food sharing is a no-no, to be honest. But unfortunately, peanut-free zones have not been as effective in preventing accidental ingestions as we would like to have thought they were.
All right, our phone number is 844-295-8255. That's a toll-free number, and I want to say hello to our listeners on WEOS in Geneva. Thanks for being with us today. We appreciate your listening as well. You can call in 844-295-8255. Let's take a telephone call now. Juan is on line one. Go right ahead, Juan.
Hi, my question is regarding what's on the horizon regarding what can be done about peanut allergy in particular. I have a 9-year-old who suffers from it. He has a high allergic sensitivity to peanuts. He's had two incidents where he's had a reaction, and I was just wondering if he doesn't outgrow it, if he's in the majority that will not, what measures can I take to try and minimize, or maybe even is there a possibility of a cure or of even management as on the horizon? And that's my question.
It's a great question, Juan, and obviously a very, very hot area of research in the world of food allergy right now. Just like you can get allergy shots for environmental allergies, there's a lot of research going on immunotherapy for foods. As of today, I just want to preface this by saying that it is absolutely being done in a research setting. We're learning a lot about it. I do not think it's ready for prime time, although you can find very reputable allergists in America willing to offer immunotherapy for foods.
And there's a lot of it in the media.
So what does it mean? So immunotherapy for food means whatever food. The research has been done mostly with peanuts, cow's milk, and eggs. But Juan's question was in regards to peanuts, so we'll talk about peanuts. So if your son is peanut allergic, Juan, in a controlled setting, never at home, in a controlled setting, you start with very, very, very exceedingly low dose of peanut protein, and over a course of time, sequentially increase that dose to a maintenance dose where your son is eating a fixed amount of peanut protein on a daily basis. Does that come with risk? Absolutely, that comes with risk. And that's something that you need to be aware of. The buildup period comes with lots of risk, and there have been bad outcomes from these during the research studies. But most people can reach a maintenance dose, and then you stay on that dose, and your son does not become unallergic if he does this. What happens is he's less sensitive if exposed to the food, and that's an important point. because the studies have shown once he stops taking a daily fixed dose, if he waits a month or two or three and then he's exposed to peanut, he's still going to have a reaction like he'd had previously.
All right, and these are just studies at this point, correct?
These are just studies. Like I said, there are reputable allergists in America who do offer this therapy. The reason I don't, and we have absolutely discussed it as a group, we've reviewed the literature, is A, there's more unknowns than knowns, I think, right now. We don't know how fast to build up. We don't know the right dose. Very importantly, when we all start medical school, we take an oath of do no harm. We don't know what the side effects are. 50% of individuals in these studies report abdominal discomfort. We don't exactly know what's going on. 5 to 20% of folks in these studies are being found to have a white blood cell in their esophagus, eosinophils in their esophagus. And that makes us worry about a condition called eosinophilic esophagitis, which I know folks out there who are familiar with food allergies may be familiar with because there's a lot of overlap. So there's a lot of side effects that we haven't quite ironed out yet.
All right. So this isn't happening in this community, but in some of the reading that I've done about where the studies are taking place, at some point the studies do sort of move into the home, right? I read some stories of parents actually administering the dose of whatever the culprit is.
Yes. So the
and
studies
it can be harrowing.
The studies have, absolutely, there are maintenance dosing that has been given at home. The harrowing part is there have been systemic reactions reported even during the maintenance phase that you're getting at home. So you're never really out of the woods. And what you're really doing is you're protecting an individual from an accidental ingestion. You're not telling a peanut allergic kid that you can go home and have, you know, three PB&Js. That's not the goal of this therapy. And it's being done at multiple centers across the country. And, you know, for full disclosure, I've done this myself on a couple of individuals in outstanding circumstances also, in a research setting and also in a clinical setting. But it's certainly something that I don't quite think we're ready to offer to the general public. With that being said, with my 15-month-old, I am very hopeful that before he goes to college, at least, that I think this will be much more routine therapy that we'll understand better and be able to offer to more folks.
What will the next steps be for these therapies to probably put if it moves through the right phases, will it be to put it in allergy center settings and then try and move it through maybe FDA, something like that?
I think the first step is where the centers they're being done at is learning more about side effects, following these people over time, learning more about the GI of the gastrointestinal side effects before we can move it into more of a widespread use. We don't even know the right form. People know about oral immunotherapy, and that's administering the food, actually ingesting it. There's sublingual forms where you put the food protein under your tongue. There's actually epicutaneous forms where you put the food that you're allergic to on your skin as a patch. We do know that the oral form seems to be the most effective of those three, but also the most dangerous. The epicutaneous form, where you actually put the food that you're allergic to on your skin in increasing doses, seems to be the safest, but also the least effective. So it's a juggling act, and we have a lot of ironing out to do.
All right, we're talking about food allergies and immunotherapy on Second Opinion Live on Healthy Friday today. You can tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP, and you can call us at our toll-free number, which is 844-295-8255. Let's take a question from Twitter now. We have somebody who's asking, do people ever develop epinephrine immunity? Is there a risk of this sole treatment to allergic reactions becoming less effective in your eyes?
The risk of never saying never. I've never heard of a case of anyone being immune to epinephrine. It's adrenaline. I think we all know what happens when we get, you know, a hit of adrenaline. If you're hiking in the woods and you see a bear, you know what you feel. That's what epinephrine does to you. So epinephrine immunity would be something that would be very difficult, near impossible to
And that moves the epinephrine, moves the body out of the swelled up sort of stage that it's in? Is that the idea?
It hits multiple levels of an allergic reaction at the molecular level and at the clinical level. And epinephrine is the only treatment for a systemic reaction. We use a lot of it in my office for allergic reactions to shots, or we do a lot of food challenges in our office. And it's remarkable. It not only works fast, it's phenomenally fantastic. 20% of significant allergic reactions will have a second wave, a biphasic phase. So you may need more than one dose of epinephrine. That's perfectly appropriate, perfectly safe. But as far as becoming immune to epinephrine, that's extraordinarily unlikely.
All right, and we're going to keep on taking questions from Twitter for a few moments. We have a few questions here. People are tweeting to the hashtag 2NDOP. And this question comes from someone who wants to know, are there any prenatal diet recommendations for moms that help infants to avoid the development of food allergies? That's a big question.
Another phenomenal question. So this is where we know what we know and we know what we don't know. And any allergist or physician at this point, the right answer there is we don't know what you should be doing when you're pregnant or when you're breastfeeding. So, therefore, we cannot make any recommendations on what you should not be doing. For example, there is no reason as of today to have a pregnant mother or a breastfeeding mother avoiding any foods. That's never been shown to help. Some studies think that decreases your risk of allergies. Some think it doesn't make a difference. But we just reviewed this recently, and as of today, a pregnant mother, a breastfeeding mother, should have a broad and unrestricted diet of her choice. We just don't have enough information on what role that diet is playing in the subsequent development of allergies.
All right, here's a question that came to us through our toll-free number, which is 844-295-8255. This is from Millie, who wanted to ask the question off the air. She wants to know whether there are problems with chocolate. She says, has anyone ever died from a chocolate allergy because she has had some resistance to chocolate? Have you heard of that?
So chocolate is cow's milk often, mm-hmm. So that would go along with cow's milk allergy. Has anyone ever died? And no individual I have taken care of, but certainly that is certainly possible. It is possible to be allergic to chocolate. And if she's having consistent issues, allergies are a consistent problem. If you're allergic to food, you're going to have trouble every time you have it. If she's having trouble with chocolate, she certainly deserves an evaluation.
All right. Our telephone number is 844-295-8255. We're in studio with Dr. Shahzad Mustafa from Rochester General Health System. Let's go to line one. Roger's on the line, and he's going to ask a question that I think was on my list about a celiac and gluten. Go ahead, Roger.
Yes, there is something being written about individuals who are gluten sensitive that do not have celiac disease. The question is that a different sort of allergy that's not an autoimmunity?
It's a good question, Roger. Celiac disease is a very specific immune problem, and the antibody responsible for celiac disease is IgA. That is not actually an allergic issue. You're not at risk of anaphylaxis or systemic issues. So gluten sensitivity is different than celiac disease. That's another potential diagnosis that, again, that's more so by history, and there's a lot of studies going on gluten sensitivity. Celiac disease is obviously a very specific diagnosis that has great diagnostic criteria. It has blood work, and you eventually need an upper endoscopy for a biopsy. But those are not hypersensitivity reactions. Those don't put you at risk of anaphylaxis. You can be allergic to wheat, but that's different than celiac disease or gluten sensitivity.
And we do sort of hear them in the same sentence from time to time, or we hear all these things where there's sensitivity or where you ingest
Absolutely.
Something and it makes you sick. It's hard to figure it all out.
Absolutely. But I think it is important that semantics do matter, and intolerance is different from an allergy. And I take that to someone who's lactose intolerant. You would never say that person is allergic to milk because they're not. And why does it matter? Because if you're intolerant, you're not at risk of anaphylaxis. If you're allergic, you are. If you're intolerant, often people can tolerate a small dose, not a big dose. You know, you can have a cube of cheese, but not an ice cream sundae. If you're allergic to milk or if you're allergic to a food, even a very, very small dose can have a very significant reaction. Folks with intolerance, folks with sensitivities don't need to have epinephrine. They don't need to have emergency action plans. Everyone with a documented food allergy should have epinephrine at their disposal and an emergency action plan. So it is nice to iron these out for very practical reasons.
All right. We have callers on the line. Our phone number is 844-295-8255. That's 295-TALK, and we appreciate your calls today. Let's go to line two. Carol's on the line. Thanks for waiting, Carol. Did you have a question?
Yes. Just recently I was diagnosed, and I don't know if I'm saying this right, the iliopsoasophagitis, is that how you say it? Started with GI problems and discovered that I'm highly allergic to sulfites, and my esophagus closed up and had. But this has been going on for a long time, and they finally diagnosed that. I'm also highly allergic to penicillin, amoxicillin drugs, have always had a history of allergies. asthma. I'm 53 years old, wondering if I should have an EpiPen. If I have an episode, I didn't realize that sulfites are even in things like graham crackers, hummus, of course, wines, vinegars. So other than avoiding, if I accidentally ingest, what's the best measure for someone like myself?
So eosinophilic esophagitis is the inflammation in the esophagus that I think you're referring to that can be associated with foods. You know, in a case like that, with I think it's been going on a while, it sounds kind of complicated. I think you certainly deserve a good evaluation from maybe starting with your primary care physician, but then also potentially your gastroenterologist or an allergist. So, you know, it's hard to get into the details of your specific case, but I think you certainly should have a full, thorough evaluation, potentially by multiple specialties.
All right, our phone number is 844-295-8255, and we're taking questions on Twitter as well. Tweet to the hashtag 2NDOP if you have a question about food allergies. You know, we talked earlier in the program about the number, the rate of food allergies being on the rise, 1 in 13 young people, but there are now an estimated 6 million kids in the United States with food allergies, nearly 1 in 10 preschoolers, and apparently the number of adults are going up too. So this is really more of it's a public health situation.
Absolutely.
At this point, right? It's not something that's individual. What do you think, what do you see on the horizon in terms of this multi-pronged setting, doctors, families, and schools? Do you see more communities coming together to address, or are there innovative things you've heard of in communities that are happening to help people deal with it?
Sure. So I think awareness is certainly a big thing in the community. It starts, you know, at the medical level, also trying to stop this increase in allergic disease in general. So I think there is some, you know, there is some progress being made. Food allergies have absolutely been rising for the last decade and a half. There has been a slight plateau in the new diagnosis of food allergies over the last 3 years.
Okay.
And it's hard to know what to attribute that to, but I would like to think that that also correlates with the time where the recommendations on delaying the introduction of the foods changed. I mentioned earlier that was around 2009, 2010. So maybe this move towards early introduction of foods has actually started to make some tangible difference in the community. And then, of course, in the community, awareness is certainly better now than it was 5, 10, 20 years ago. And that has to happen on multiple levels. And education, raising awareness is huge there. And I'm going
to
take this opportunity. Can I plug an event?
Plug? Yes, I know we're doing something in this community, right?
Myself and Dr. Bingaman, again, with our practice, and our practice is leading a food allergy awareness day at Frontier Field for the Rochester Red Wings. It's on Sunday, June 29th. It's the 1 o'clock game. It's going to have discounted tickets if you go through the Food Allergy Awareness Program, and we're going to have some great information and some folks before the game say a couple words, and then we'll have some great information there. Because, again, education and information is key. So that's June 29th at 1 o'clock. It's a great opportunity to raise awareness and come out as a community for this problem that affects really a lot everyone. If you're not diagnosed yourself, I'm almost certain you know someone with a food allergy.
All right. We have a few minutes left in our conversation, and before we run out of time, I want to make sure that, Dr. Mustafa, you have the opportunity to do something for us that we often do on Second Opinion, the television show, and that is that we do some myth-busting on that program, and I wonder if you would take a few minutes to dispel some of the more common food allergy myths that you have heard.
So I give you the myth and I dispel
you,
it.
You may give me the myth and you get the control of everything.
So I think very important is airborne exposure. I am very, very adamant when I take care of individuals that you need to know that the only food that has been documented to have scientific evidence of airborne risk of systemic reaction is seafood. Peanut has not. That's very, very important. You can sit in a room with a peanut if you're peanut allergic, and you should absolutely be safe. There's lots of studies. Same goes for dairy. Same goes for eggs. So that's a big one. An older myth that still is lingering, I think it's very important. If you have an egg allergy, if your kid has an egg allergy, they absolutely can receive the flu shot. The flu shot does have egg protein in it. It is absolutely safe. There have been multiple studies with thousands of people. The CDC recommends the flu shot in egg allergic individuals. I think that is a very big public health issue because many people with food allergies also have asthma. And we know folks with respiratory disease should particularly get the flu shot.
All right, quickly, you just said many people with allergies also have asthma. Also, eczema is a word that we hear associated with food allergies and asthma. What is there something about this particular pathology,
this pathology is based on IgE antibodies often, and it's called the atopic march. It's very stereotypic. The first thing that an individual does often as a young child is get eczema or atopic dermatitis. Then they either wheeze with a cold or they develop asthma, they develop a food allergy. And then the last thing they do is they get allergic rhinitis or environmental allergies. So it's kind of a 4-for-1 deal for many, many individuals. Allergies, eczema, asthma, and environmental allergies. And these things are kind of scientifically grouped together.
So does that mean your child is doomed if they show up with an allergy? You think the rest of it's not far behind?
It certainly increases their risk. There's no for certains in medicine. But my son, for example, has a much higher risk of having asthma than a baseline individual, about 8 to 10%. For most folks, his is higher. He's doomed from environmental allergies. My wife and I both have environmental allergies. He has food allergies. So very, very high risk. I'd say I'd put it at 80 to 90% risk. So these are all risk factors in understanding it, but nothing can tell you one way or the other for sure.
Risk factors you discussed. Are there environmental factors that are involved in the development of allergies in kids, would you say?
So this goes back to why are allergies on the rise. I think the leading theory, I'll put it out there, which because I think a lot of people are familiar with it, is the hygiene hypothesis. There's kind of two arms.
That we're too clean?
We're almost too clean, yeah. We the arm of our immune system that is responsible for allergic reactions is also the arm of the immune system that has historically been responsible for fighting parasitic disease. And unless you guys have been on any lovely trips to the third world or anything recently, we haven't been exposed to too much parasite in our world, which is great. We have less infections, less infectious disease. But I think with every yin comes a yang. And at the cost of that, I think we may be having more allergic disease. That is not certain. That is not based in science yet. But that is certainly a strong hypothesis for why are these allergic diseases increasing? Why are we overreacting to what should be very benign substances?
All right, we have a question from Twitter that came in a few minutes ago. Somebody's asking about alternative ingredients to common allergens. Are there resources out there for people where they can figure out sort of how to live and
Absolutely.
You know, cook in an alternate way, that kind of thing?
So a very important part when you're avoiding is keeping your nutrition up. You don't want to become nutritionally deficient anyway, so alternatives. So that would be a great question for a physician and allergist. There are good resources. One resource is the FAIR Network, Food Allergy Research Education. The website, if I can throw it out there, it's foodallergy.org. And they have a lot of resources. If you're milk allergic, what kind of products? Could you have soy milk, which is yes, almond milk, coconut milk? There's a lot of substitutes out there. My son has gone from peanut butter. Now he has soy nut butter, which is a great alternative. So you absolutely need to be an advocate for yourself. Ask your physician. And there are resources out there also.
One of the things that we did not hear asked in this hour, so I'll ask it, is what will the sort of regimen be? What will the process be if you suspect a food allergy? I guess you might suspect a food allergy if your child has some kind of a reaction. Then you'll go in and see the physician, maybe a specialist. Then what happens?
Yeah, I think the first thing that should tip you off is the right constellation of symptoms. In children, it can be a little more vague, but you eat a food, you get a rash typically within minutes. You want to tell your physician. I think the ideal way is to start with skin testing, but unfortunately only allergists can do skin testing. So sometimes we start with blood work, which is okay as long as the blood work is interpreted. Like I said, there's no yes or no blood work. There's no black or white answer. Mm-hmm. So once you see a blood work, I think everyone with a potential food allergy should see an allergist, because even if it's as simple as you're allergic to peanuts, avoid it. You need to know about likelihood of outgrowing it. You need to know about other nuances, which I think allergists are absolutely best equipped to take care of.
All right. And what about, you said it a little earlier, and we haven't gone back to it, but you mentioned probiotics in all of this. Where do they fall down? Because you do read a lot in the media about probiotics and the benefits of probiotics. I'll put that in quotations.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of research going on probiotics, herbal supplementations. As of today, there's no black or white evidence that they hurt or harm. So I always tell folks, you're more than welcome to use alternative medications, herbal medications, probiotics. Just please be aware, just because you can buy it over the counter at a store doesn't necessarily mean it's safe. So certainly I think this is an active area of research, and I wish I could comment more on it, but I don't have any more information today. But it's absolutely being looked at.
Do you see differences in terms of the rates of food allergies based on other community factors, socioeconomic status, things like that? How are people affected?
That's also a great question. So there is a socioeconomic bias for an ethnic bias for food allergies. for higher socioeconomic classes being more affected for food allergy than lower socioeconomic classes. And it's hard to know what to make of that. Is that the allergy is the same throughout, but folks with more access to healthcare are being diagnosed more? Or is it actually a true incidence where folks with, you know, higher household income are actually experiencing more food allergies? I don't have the answer to that. But we're looking at all these risk factors to try to figure out what the heck is going on here and try to curb it and decrease this increase.
All right. We're going to finish up today with a question that harkens back to something you said earlier in the hour. You talked about, we talk about allergies as being a life and death situation because they can be, but you also mentioned that it's also a quality of life situation. You seem pretty calm when you're talking about food allergies, even though your son has an allergy. Can you describe what you mean by quality of life again versus life or death?
So absolutely. Any food allergy has a potential for a life-threatening reaction, particularly peanuts, tree nuts, and shellfish. Anything is possible, but those three are the usual suspects. Honestly, if you are treating reactions with epinephrine, the risk of bad outcomes is very, very low. Like I said, there was just a recent study. There's a couple hundred deaths in America from anaphylaxis in general, and if you take that to foods, the number is around 60 or 80, which is certainly a number that we would like to prevent. But 60 or 80 versus every single person's quality of life is affected is a much more day-to-day going to the grocery store, going to the friend's house, going to school, going to work. Is the quality of life is imperative to maintain because food allergies have a huge impact on quality of life. So you don't want to be overdiagnosed. You don't want to be avoiding foods that you're not allergic to. And then once you have it, you want to manage it based on information, whether it's school policies, airborne risk. There's a whole host of this. And this is a great conversation to have with your allergist. It doesn't take 2 minutes or 3 minutes. It's a long conversation, but it's a worthwhile one because if you can protect your quality of life, this is just one other thing that you deal with, and it just becomes a part of your daily kind of fabric of how you live.
All right, that's all the time we have for our discussion. I'll take one more opportunity to tell you about Food Allergy Awareness Day at Frontier Field on June 29th. If you're in Rochester, New York, Dr. Mustafa and his colleagues will be at Frontier Field on June 29th at 1 o'clock to help the community understand food allergies better. Thank you so much for being here, Dr.
Shehzad
Mustafa.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you to our sponsor, Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. Their support helped make today's program possible. And thanks to all of you for listening on WXXI AM 1370, WEOS in Geneva, and for watching on secondopinion-tv.org. A reminder, this program is medical information. It is not medical advice. If you have a health care concern, please see your primary care physician or your health care provider. We'll be back here for another Healthy Friday and Second Opinion Live on June 20th when we'll talk about a heated topic, medical marijuana. I'm Elisa Orlando. We'll see you then.